This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carey Jr. II. He's the show's producer.
Hello.
So, Carey, the Pulitzer Prizes in journalism and books were announced recently, yes. And there were a number of winners whose work focused on the same kind of things we talk about here on Created Equal: inequality, challenges to things like democratic participation and fairness under the law. So I thought it might be interesting to talk to a couple of them.
Yeah, talk to a couple of them. And I think what we ended up with are some really interesting conversations about topics I hadn't initially thought of so specifically and so much detail.
Right.
So I think it worked out. I think it's a nice approach to kind of elevating some of the other themes that we like to touch on in the show.
Yeah, and we're starting today with Jacqueline Jones, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Texas in Austin. She wrote a book titled No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era, which goes to your point about the kind of detailed analysis that some of this work gets into, this idea of what was happening to African Americans who were free because they lived in Massachusetts, but were still subject to an incredible amount of discrimination because they were black.
I mean, that's exactly what it was. I was like, wait a minute. Oh, in Boston. Oh, in the North. I mean, and so I was like, this will be interesting to see what like, I have a suspicion of what this will look like. But once you get into the work, she really gets into a lot of interesting elements of it, of what people did in spite of the fact that they didn't have work opportunities, how much they got paid. She asked questions of where and why there weren't more support for those black people. So that was really interesting for me to understand.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of allies, right, in the fight for abolition, people who worked with African Americans to get rid of slavery, kind of thought their work was done once slavery went away in places like Massachusetts and stopped fighting for real equality, the kind of things that would give people opportunity to be equal.
Well, obviously, we're going to get to the theme of there's going to be race in here, obviously.
Yeah.
But the theme of work, I think, is heavier and more more salient for me than I had anticipated before getting into this topic.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get to Jacqueline Jones, author of No Right to an Honest Living. Jacqueline Jones, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So first, let me say congratulations for winning the Pulitzer Prize recently for No Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. Were you surprised by the win?
Yes, I was shocked. <That's> I wasn't excellent. Expecting it. Yeah.
So I want to set the stage here a little before we talk specifically about the subject of the book, which is about work. I want to talk about Boston and Boston pre-Civil War. And I want to do that because I think it's indicative of a number of things that we don't often think about in pre-Civil War America. So Boston is a part of Massachusetts, which was a free state, which made African Americans who were living in Boston not among the enslaved population in the United States. But free is, I think, a kind of loose term in the way that we use it. And I don't think it means what everyone has come to think that it means. So no, African Americans were not enslaved in Boston, but give us a sense of what their lives were like from the perspective of freedom versus slavery.
Yes, well, many people have argued that Massachusetts was particularly enlightened in terms of Black civil rights by 1860. As you point out, there were no enslaved people in Massachusetts. the Constitution, the state's Constitution of 1780, outlawed slavery. Essentially, by 1860, black and white children could attend the same public school. Intermarriage was legal. The Constitution of 1780 also guaranteed black men the right to vote if they were property owners. And many of them did, not that they owned their own homes, but they owned furniture. They mm-hmm. owned personal estates. So they did vote in local, state, and national elections. So by these measures, again, many people claim that Boston and Massachusetts were particularly enlightened. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to look at that literature because it really is very extensive, the literature on the struggle for Black civil rights in the antebellum North. I wanted to look at it, but look past these rights of citizenship, suffrage, intermarriage, integration of schools, serving on a jury, running for office, these sorts of things. I wanted to look past these things and see what people were doing in the workplace.
It's not simple, right? I mean,
it's not simple. It's not simple. I mean, there is no right to work embedded in the Constitution. So it's not a right. There's no right to attend school, for that matter. And I don't think the Constitution even mentions voting. But we've come to see citizenship in, I think, broad terms. At the same time, the right to work and earn a decent wage has not been part of our definition of citizenship historically. So that's the big problem, because no matter how many black men could vote in Massachusetts in 1860, if conditions in the workplace were unequal and unjust, then yes, black people remained really second class citizens, if true citizens at all, actually.
Yeah. So let's talk about what work looked like in Boston pre-Civil War with regard to black people, with regard to white people. What were the differences?
Well, first of all, Boston during this period, the antebellum period right before the Civil War, was a post-emancipation society. And in certain ways, it foreshadowed what was going to happen in the South after the Civil War. Mm. More particularly, enslaved men and women who were very skilled lost that ability to work at their trades after they became free. Their tools had belonged to their owner, so they lost access to their tools. Mm. And also white customers tended not to support black tradesmen. So we see the vast majority of black men and women during this period doing what is essentially unskilled, menial labor. It was arduous labor in many instances. I'm thinking of black laundresses, for instance. Mm-hmm. That's really hard work, lugging that laundry through the streets mm-hmm. and then washing it, hanging it up, ironing it, really under very primitive conditions. So, but most black workers were engaged in menial work. The men often in what's called casual work. And that means that they really had to scrounge for work from day to day, look for an hour here, a day there, a paid labor. And it was extremely unpredictable. It was low paying. It was exploitative. One of the interesting things I found was that black men and women in 1900 were doing essentially the same things as they were doing in 1840 in the workplace. In other words, even though there were these cataclysmic events in the nation's history, the Civil War, which claimed 700,000 lives, the Second Industrial Revolution, the emergence of the retail sector, black men and women really doing about what they were doing before the war. And that has all sorts of implications, of course, for long range inequality.
Sure. So I want to talk about why this was true. And I guess what I'm getting at there is the role that de facto segregation and discrimination comes to play in post-Civil War America. That with the war and then the passage of the three Civil War amendments, which outlaw slavery and provide equal protection and protect the vote, that wipes away on paper, at least, the inequalities that most of the inequalities that exist between black and white people. But there, the biases that had produced slavery, the biases that had produced unequal protection, the biases that had denied the vote to African Americans, they persist. And so this idea of equality and what it means comes to mean something very different once slavery is off the table, once denying the vote is off the table. This is what we're seeing in Massachusetts at this time, correct?
Yes, although I think instead of saying, you know, black people face discrimination in the workplace, which is certainly true, we should go beyond that. I look at six different groups of potential white allies. Mm-hmm. And I define these groups as men in authority, men of influence, who had the power, if they had chosen to exercise that power, to serve as advocates for black people in economic terms. Mm-hmm. And I go systematically through these six groups and find that all of them had their own reasons to discriminate or to not advocate in any kind of positive way. So beginning here with the abolitionists, the white abolitionists who in Boston were known for being outspoken, for being radical, for being militant, William Lloyd Garrison, Theodore Parker, Wendell Phillips. All of these men were men of courage, and Boston actually was a very conservative city, and these men faced tremendous hostility from the general population. Garrison was mobbed and dragged through the streets, and they did work tirelessly on behalf of enslaved people in the South, working for abolition. But they showed very little concern for their black neighbors in Boston. Hmm. And I think the reason for that was Garrison in particular wanted to continue to fund his magazine, The Liberator, his newspaper. He wanted to fund the anti-slavery society that he founded. And he worried that he would alienate men of means, white men of means in Boston, if he press this issue of workplace integration or justice for black people in the workplace. In other words, there were very wealthy men who were willing to support the abolitionist cause, but they were not willing to offend their white workers and to seek to integrate their workforces. So we find really a studied indifference. In fact, the silence is deafening on the part of white abolitionists during this period. I also look at the Republicans, the Republican Party founded in 1854 as an anti-slavery party, not wanting slavery to be extended into the new Western territories. But these men who often professed egalitarian principles again showed very little interest in the plight of black men and women at work in Boston. And part of the issue here is that black voters constituted such a small proportion of the electorate. They were really not considered a meaningful constituency among the Republicans during this period. So very few Republican candidates talk about the workplace, talk about work. It's really not of interest to them, and they feel they can count on black votes regardless, because of course the Republicans become the party of Lincoln and the party of the Emancipation Proclamation and so forth. Two other groups I look at, military veterans. We know, of course, that about 180,000 black men served the Union cause on land and on the sea. And yet, after the war, white veterans segregated their units. And whenever they held celebrations about, the victory of the war, those celebrations inevitably left Black men out. And in fact, by the early 20th century, white Union veterans and white Confederate veterans are meeting as a kind of reconciliation in some of these reunions. And yet again, the sacrifices of Black men are really kept left out of these celebrations. And the final group I look at is here in the late 19th century, the academics, the social workers in Boston, who again are primarily concerned with white residents of the city, but also in the end, they do justify the exclusion of Black men and women from certain kinds of work, from factory work, from retail sales, the women from secretarial work. And the argument seems to be, well, Black people have never had these jobs, so they must be incapable of doing them. So that's a circular argument, to say the least, and hypocritical. But social workers and academics are really, in a way, I think, pressing this pseudo-scientific racism that comes to the fore in the late 19th century. So just to summarize, I would say, again, yes, there is discrimination in the workplace, but I think we have to look at the agents of that discrimination. And we find a large number of groups. We find white workers who don't want to work with Black people. We find white employers who don't want to offend their white workers, city authorities. The list goes on. And again, these groups have their own reason, I think, for discriminating against Black people or showing just tremendous indifference right. toward their hardship.
Well, and the sum total of their action or inaction is persistent inequality. It's that the promises of freedom from slavery, the promises of the vote, the promises of the other freedoms that Blacks are enjoying in Massachusetts, they don't mean as much as they should.
Yes, that's absolutely true. We can ask ourselves, what is the meaning of the right to vote if one cannot make a decent living for one's family? And what this means long term, of course, is that Black households have to continue to rent. They can't afford to buy their own house. And that has obviously long-term implications. These Black households can't develop intergenerational wealth. They can't build up their own assets. They can't bequeath these assets to their children and grandchildren. There was a study in 2015 by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston that found that the median net worth of white households in the city was about $250,000, $247,000. The median net worth of Black households in the city was $8.
Wow.
So that is the legacy of this persistent discrimination in the workplace.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue talking with Jacqueline Jones about her book about workers, Black workers in Boston before the Civil War. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad that you have joined us. Our guest today is Jacqueline Jones. She's a professor emeritus of women's history and Southern history at the University of Texas. She's also the author of a book titled No Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. It was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for history earlier this year. Jacqueline, I want to start this part of the conversation talking more about the consequences of this inability to get fair work or to get equal work for Black workers in Massachusetts before the war, and what Black lives looked like as a result. You were talking before the break about the difference in assets, household assets, for instance, that were evident even back then because of this. But the lives of these Black workers were also deeply affected by this line between what they could do and what they couldn't.
Yes. And I think one issue that we need to keep in mind here is the great fear that many white workers had before the war, and indeed during and after the war, that large numbers of newly freed slaves would migrate out of the South and into the North and depress wages for white workers. So there is this sense that Black people, at least in large numbers, represent a real threat to the well-being of white families. And as I said, the war raises those issues again. What will happen to 3.5 million formerly enslaved people once the war is over? Well, we know that formerly enslaved people wanted to stay in the region of their forebears. They wanted to stay near their kin, that they, for the most part, had very little interest in moving north. I do talk about one exception to that, and that is the hundreds of refugees in Virginia, there on the peninsula, who right after the war, under the sponsorship of the Freedmen's Bureau, moved from Virginia to Boston. And these were mostly women and children, because the idea was that, well, many white women don't want to work as domestic servants. It's really hard labor. It's ill paid. It's 24/7 working under an imperious employer. And so they're headed off to work as retail clerks or to work in the factories, to work as machine operatives. And so who will fill their places when they leave domestic servants? Well, the idea was that Black women and children from the South would fill their places. But that doesn't really affect the white labor market much, because as I said, the white women were leaving domestic service in any case. But it was this fear, you know, and it was a fear that union leaders pushed, you know, we have to be careful, we're going to be inundated with cheap labor if we don't watch it. And that was all part of the political landscape of Boston before the war, too.
Yeah. The work that African Americans are able to find and not find also leads to some real negative consequences as well. Crime is one of them.
Right. And I do include in the book, because I am talking about ways to make a living, ways to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. I do include labor in the underground economy. That's a kind of illicit labor. It might involve bootlegging or gambling. I look particularly at Joseph F. Clash, who ran a dance hall. And it was connected to a brothel. He was a con man, actually, but very successful because of this dance hall. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at pickpockets, sex workers, card sharps, you find, you know, people struggling to make a living. And it's a very dangerous kind of living. I don't want to romanticize it at all. But it led me into some interesting avenues. One was the what I call the fugitive imposters. These are men and women who claim to be fugitives from slavery and are looking to buy their loved ones out of bondage in the South. Mm. And they appeal to white and black abolitionists for funds in order to do that. And the imposters are not former slaves. They're free people posing as formerly enslaved people. And wow. If they have a good story, they can, you know, get bribe some money out of these well-meaning, sympathetic abolitionists. And that was a particular way of making a living that was available only to Black people. Mm-hmm. Only they could try it. It involved being a good performer, having a good story, and also being able to get out of town at the right moment before you're exposed as a fraud. So that was one interesting kind of work I found. I also talk a little bit about a man who was stopped on the street one night by a Boston police officer. This was a Black man, and the officer noted that he had a burlap bag on his shoulder and sternly ordered him to put the bag on the ground, assuming it was stolen goods of some kind, and the man did. And then the officer noticed that the bag was wriggling, and it had lots of rats in it. Mm-hmm. This was a man who collected rats in the stables and then sold them to the dog pits. Those were pits where men would bet on how long it would take a dog to kill a certain number of rats. Mm-hmm. And the man who collected these rats was very entrepreneurial. He was very resourceful. He was proud of himself. He said he had collected probably $5 worth of rats that night, which was really a good haul for that time. Mm-hmm. But I do too, besides this illicit economy, look at those few Black men and women who really made a good living as well. I didn't want to ignore them because they were certainly influential in Boston. They were well known. We're talking about Robert Morris, an attorney who had Black and white clients, Leonard Grimes, the pastor of 12th Baptist Church, also, Madame Carteau, mm-hmm. who was what she called a hair doctress, mm-hmm. J.B. Smith, a well-known caterer, who was very well-to-do, and John Bailey, who owned a gymnasium. So, you know, these are really, they're exceptional workers,
yeah.
they're entrepreneurs, there's business people, but they're part of the story, too.
Yeah, yeah. You make much in the book of this being in the North and this being a Northern problem. Can you compare what these freed African Americans in Massachusetts before the war were experiencing to what African Americans experienced in the South once slavery went away? You referenced that earlier, but I want to talk a little more about what those differences looked like.
Again, I think they're in both sections, we see skilled Black workers losing their trade over time, mm-hmm. not being able to bequeath that trade, the tools of the trade, to their children. And as I said, there are a couple of reasons there. One is that Black tradespeople find it hard to build up a consumer base mm-hmm. among whites. Mm-hmm. These whites will patronize the owner of an enslaved skilled worker, but they will not patronize a Black skilled worker who yeah. is free. And that distinction, I think, is made in both the North and the South. I do follow a group that came north in 1847 from Virginia. These were enslaved people who had been freed by the will of their owner, Carter Edloe. Mm-hmm. He died in 1844 and stipulated that all of the enslaved people on his plantation should be freed. They decided to come, and I should say that for them, Boston seemed to offer really a much better life than if they had stayed in Virginia. they knew that Black people, Black men could vote in Boston, that there was a very vital social life for Black people in the city, that the Black community was very well organized, that the churches were large and influential. I mean, for all these reasons, Black life in Boston was much more vital than it could have been for free Blacks in antebellum Virginia. But of course, after the war, the vast majority of emancipated slaves worked in the fields. Mm-hmm. And that was very different from Boston, of course, where most were these casual day laborers or domestic servants.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jacqueline Jones, professor emeritus of women's history and Southern history at the University of Texas and author of No Honest Living, Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson from WDET in Detroit, and I'm talking with Jacqueline Jones. She's a professor emeritus of women's history and Southern history at the University of Texas and the author of No Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. The book was recently awarded the Pulitzer Prize for History. Jacqueline, I want to talk about what this tells us about today, what this tells us about race today, what this tells us about work today. It's really interesting, I think, to understand how segregated work was pre-Civil War in a free state in the United States. Of course, all of the states become free states after the war, and nearly 200 years later, we continue to struggle with these very issues. What does your book tell us about our understanding of those inequalities now?
Yes, well, I think, you know, a lot of these problems that I've outlined still persist. The unwillingness of union leaders always to match their egalitarian rhetoric with actions in the workplace, mm-hmm. the indifference of politicians, their unwillingness to rock the boat and argue for economic justice for Black men and women. I think, you know, often this issue of work gets left out of the mix. Mm-hmm. We focus on voting, which is obviously a foundation of citizenship. It's a keystone of citizenship. But again, as I pointed out, voting is not always the avenue to a just society. And one may be enfranchised and still face tremendous problems in the workplace. So, you know, and it's all bound up with education. Today we have very segregated forms of education. Essentially, you know, you are your zip code, mm-hmm. in a sense, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, well-funded suburban schools provide really an excellent education, help their students get into college. Poor communities cannot afford the resources, the computers, the guidance counselors that suburban schools take for granted. Assets, we've talked about the difference in assets between Black and white households, mm-hmm. and that might obviously affect whether a family feels its children can go to college or not. So we do have still a social division of labor that privileges white people in this country. If you look at certain kinds of work, you'll see that they're often dominated by either whites or Blacks. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly a remnant of not only 19th century discrimination, but also this legacy, these cascading effects of asset accumulation or lack thereof over the generations.
And yet it's hard to assert that in our culture now without some pushback, right? Without someone saying, well, there are other things that explain that. The idea that this is rooted in our history, I think, is difficult for people to grasp.
Yes, it is. When I taught the American History Survey, my students felt that by the mid-1960s was the passage of the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, the first supposedly guaranteeing equality in the workplace, or at least lessening these barriers against people of color in the workplace. The second, of course, focused on the right to vote. My students say, well, kind of, case closed. Okay, we've done it. We've eliminated these legal barriers. We're making sure that the federal government is not an agent of discrimination anymore. This is just really a transformative moment in our history. So now, no one has any excuse anymore because there are no formal barriers. And it took some effort for me to remind my students of where many Black families found themselves in 1965, still renting, still in communities without the resources of suburban communities, and to say, well, now things are equal, just go ahead and do your best, was really a very naive way of looking at the problems. But as you say, some people persist in that view that somehow the playing field is level now. People have to take responsibility for themselves, not realizing the tremendous advantages whole swaths of white people have at this point.
Mm-hmm. And in pre-Civil War Boston, how much was this a subject of debate? How agitated were African Americans about the persistence of inequality despite the lack of slavery and despite the ability to vote? And how conscious was the white community that that the abolition hadn't meant equality, that it didn't mean true freedom?
Well, as I mentioned, the Black community was very well organized in Boston before the war. And I begin the book with a quote from John S. Rock. Dr. Rock was born in New Jersey, trained first as a dentist, then as a physician. He became a public lecturer of some note. He lectured on French literature, among other topics. And he ended his career as an attorney and was actually the first Black man to be admitted to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court. Anyway, I just wanted to make a note of John Rock, who isn't that well known. But I began with a speech he gave in 1860 where he said, our white abolitionist friends here are letting us down. They say they are our friends, and they purport to have an interest in our welfare. But if we look at what we're doing in the workplace, we can see that that is not really the case. And Frederick Douglass, the famous escaped slave, made the same argument that the abolitionists were hypocrites. They talked one moment about the suffering slave, but in the other moment, they patronized establishments that barred Blacks from entering and so forth. And my point here was that it took a very courageous activist during this period, particularly Rock and Douglass, to make this case for a couple of reasons. One is that I think the majority of Black citizens in Boston were really grateful to these white abolitionists who were making such a powerful statement, not only in Massachusetts, but to the whole country and to the whole world about the evils of slavery. And so to stand up in public and to, for whatever reason, denounce William Lloyd Garrison, which is what Rock and Douglass did at different points, that was a really that was a really brave thing to do, but it was also a dangerous thing to do, and not a lot of Black men and women activists were willing to go down that route in Boston in the late antebellum period. So, yes, but certainly the workers themselves understood their own liabilities. They well understood their plight, the kinds of jobs they were not allowed to apply for, and so forth. But whites, you know, by this time are concocting a narrative of inequality, a narrative of inferiority that affects Black people. And it says basically, well, these are the descendants of descendants of enslaved people here in Massachusetts, or they're refugees from slavery in the South. And they are naturally poor. In other words, this is just the state of things that really cannot be remedied by human intervention. In other words, this poverty is going to be perennial because it's natural. Right. And you see that phrase being used. And in that sense, these white men and women let themselves off the hook because essentially they're saying, you know, there's not much we can do about it. This is just the way things are. This is a God-ordained situation. And that's, you know, and we'll always need people to do the drudge work in society. And these people who are descendants of slaves should be grateful they're no longer enslaved. I mean, there are a lot of rationalizations. There are a lot of justifications for this very unequal system. And they let white people really convince themselves they don't have any responsibility for this system.
So I want to spend the rest of the time talking a little about how this work fits in some of the other work that you've done. You've written a number of books about inequality and barriers. Lots of them have to do with gender barriers, but they also have to do with race and this period of time. What does this story tell us about that broader sense of our struggle with both race and gender in history?
Well, I think the book represents a culmination of sorts. Certainly, I consider myself a labor historian. One of my first books was called Labor of Love, Labor of Sorrow, Black Women Work in the Family, where I talked about this conflict for Black women between the demands of the workplace, the demands of the marketplace on the one hand, and the demands of their home life on the other. And that... excuse me, that lasted from, that book focused on the period from slavery to the present. I also looked at Black and white sharecroppers in the South in a book called The Dispossessed, where I noted that sharecropping was really a brutal system, but these families, Black and white families, were very similar to each other. They had large numbers of children. The wives tended to marry early. The husbands married late after they were able to establish a household of their own. They were often in debt to the landowner. They moved often. I mean, there were all sorts of similarities between Black and white sharecropping families. But what happened was a lot of white families got the opportunity to work in textile mills in the South. And that gave them an opportunity to work for wages. It gave them access to schools. It gave them a community there in the villages. And that was considered a superior, a much better kind of work than working in the fields picking cotton. I also looked at what I call the social division of labor over time in a book called American Work, where I found these notions of race to be very fluid, very fungible. That is, in one time, in one place, Black people are considered suitable for certain kinds of work, and that's not true in another time and place. Hmm. So again, these notions of race, I call them racial ideologies, are very fluid, very changing, depending on the times, depending on the place, depending on the needs of people in power, landowners, so forth, for exploited labor. Hmm. So these are some of the issues I look at. Again, I look at racial ideologies over time in a book called A Dreadful Deceit. That was a quote from David Walker in Boston, wrote a very militant tract called An Appeal to Black People in the United States and all over the world, where he decried this unequal division of labor. Hmm. And he said the whole idea of race as God-ordained hierarchy of groups of people on the basis of skin color or whatever, he said that's a fiction. Yeah. That's a deceit. And yet it is a deceit that is constantly promoted and enforced and reinforced here in America. So that book, again, looked at this idea of racial ideologies. It's very fluid and very useful for people who wanted to exploit certain groups of workers.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Jacqueline Jones, it was really wonderful to have you with us here on Created Equal. And again, many congratulations for the Pulitzer Prize that your book just won.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Steve, so I wasn't able to join you in that conversation, but what were your initial takeaways?
I mean, the detail that Jacqueline Jones was able to kind of unearth about the working conditions for African Americans in Boston mm-hmm. During this period, about the consequences in their lives mm-hmm. because they couldn't get the work that they wanted. It is a really thorough look at all of the things that were going on and all of the people who were interacting with that community and why they weren't doing more
right.
to make it better, to make equality mean something.
Yeah, for me, I think it's the, there's the broader understanding of where were the abolitionists when it comes to providing or supporting these Black Bostonians and getting well-paid jobs. And I think there was a point in her talk where she said that they were more concerned about freeing the Black people in the South than they were about getting decent working conditions for the Black people in Boston. Did she say that during the interview?
We had that conversation during the interview.
Okay.
That when she was describing these different classifications mm-hmm. of white people in the North mm-hmm. and how they were failing to mm-hmm. advocate for Black workers, she talked a lot about them being distracted by slavery, mm-hmm. that they thought that was the evil that needed to be erased, and they didn't have to do more.
For me, it was I just thought, okay, the circumstances now that is created by this issue creates a need that these people have, that mm-hmm. Black people have, that they have to solve no matter what.
Yes.
And so now, these are folks who are entrepreneurial minded, who are like,
sure,
I need to figure out a way
and
to—
survival minded.
And survival right? minded, who yeah. need to be like, I need to figure out how I'm going to get my money.
Yeah.
And so I think that idea of the circumstances create the survival mentality for you to find work regardless of how society respects that role or not just has me thinking about now in present day how I think about what's respectable and not respectable. And this caused me to kind of reconsider that, be like, well, maybe we should all be rethinking how we perceive it.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly an unnecessary and unfair disdain that gets attached to certain mm-hmm. jobs, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there always has been, and that's not okay,
right?
There is dignity in all work. There's dignity in the idea of getting up every day and going to work and earning you know, a paycheck and managing yourself so that you can keep a job. All of those things are worthy of respect. That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.